this week on Behind the Lens. The New Orleans City Council delays a vote on a $900,000 contract with a nonprofit that was backed by Mayor LaToya Cantrell. Michael Isaac Stein has the details. And NOLA Public Schools is boasting a 20-point increase in its graduation rate index, but that's not the same as the actual graduation rate. Marta Jusen explains. Also, the story of Aaron Hunter's arrest, trial, and conviction has been called a, quote, tragedy with many authors. I sat down with reporter Nick Krastel to talk about his report. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
The New Orleans City Council delayed a vote this week on a $900,000 contract with Family Center of Hope, a local nonprofit. The group had a previous contract with the city for a $2.7 million community center built with public funds that still sits vacant years after its completion. Michael Isaac Stein has been reporting on the many layers of this case, and he joins me now. Michael, let's start with the current contract that's on the table for Family Center of Hope to operate a, quote, evening reporting center. What are the details?
Yeah, so the evening reporting center is something that the council has been talking about for a while now. The idea of it is basically it's about juvenile court. So the idea is that some kids arrested on certain charges should not be sent directly to the JJIC, the Juvenile Detention Center, and instead they should be routed towards more social services. The idea being that, you know, once a kid steps into detention, there's a psychological aspect there of actually, you know, physically stepping into the system like that. So they've been working on this for a while now. Earlier this year, they were working on a contract with another organization, the Youth Empowerment Project, YEP. But YEP ended up backing out of that project. So this is kind of the second attempt to get that done.
How would this evening reporting center run?
It's mostly at the discretion of the juvenile judges. Basically, they would look at some, I mean, there's some kids that would be ineligible. So for example, if they're accused of a crime of violence, they would not be eligible if they have a past conviction for murder or rape. So it's not that everyone's going to be eligible. And this is a 15-person program. It's a pilot program to start. So basically, a juvenile judge would see a case and say, this kid doesn't need to be stuck in detention. So instead, you go to this evening reporting center, and there the idea, you know, some of these details aren't fully fleshed out yet, but there would be social programming, education, you know, things of that sort. And so, again, this is a pilot project with the idea being that eventually there would be one of these evening reporting centers in all five council districts. So they're starting with one with a pretty limited size, and then they want to make that bigger.
It sounds like it would almost be like sort of equivalent to probation for juveniles, you know, someplace that you were sort of required to check in as part of your involvement in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, and I think how that looks, you know, it's been a central concern from the council because it could look more like probation where you have to check in and it feels like you're involved with the criminal justice system, or you could design it to feel more like you're in the education system, right? So I think there's a how you actually, you know, put this into place and design it is important in terms of how that kind of feels. Again, whether it feels like the criminal justice system or it feels like a social service.
And so what we have is this Family Center of Hope that has been offered a contract of $900,000 to run this evening reporting center. The city council has to approve that contract. What do we know about Family Center of Hope?
Yeah, so I actually, for this story, I actually leaned pretty heavily on writing from 2013-2014 that my editor, Charles Maldonado, had written. So back then, he had covered an attempt by that nonprofit, by the Family Center, to build a community center on Washington Avenue, right near the corner of Washington Avenue and Broad. It actually, if you remember that crash with the police chase that ended with a crash and that beauty salon caught on fire, it's right next to there. And the public funding for this building actually goes all the way back to 2002. So in 2002, the Family Center received a $350,000 grant to buy this building. you know, it kind of nothing really happens for a while until 2007 when they start to get all of these promises of public funding to build a community center at that space. And they're promised over $3 million between 2007 and 2012. We know they actually received $2.7 million of it. However, a community center never actually materialized. You know, as of last week when I went and checked, it was still a vacant building, still had paper on the windows and didn't seem to be furnished in the inside. So it was kind of a long road that kind of led to nowhere. And the family center also ended up in legal trouble over this. They were part of six different lawsuits. One contractor claimed that they were owed $1.6 million. They ended up getting a default judgment of $450,000. So, you know, again, there's kind of this rocky history with this site and this charity and you know, these millions of dollars in public funds that kind of never went anywhere.
And now they're potentially up for another hefty contract.
Yeah, and one thing that I should add that came out at the meeting on Thursday is that the Evening Reporting Center would actually be housed in that same building. So that same building that was supposed to be a community center that received, you know, $2.7 million in public funding. So it's basically the city sinking even more money into this same exact site.
Yeah, and you mentioned a concern that came up on Thursday. There were other concerns expressed by the city council in their decision to delay a vote on this contract. So what are their other concerns and what did they eventually decide?
Yeah, I think off the bat, there were kind of some just typos and mistakes in the contract that made some people uneasy. So for example, the contract is for $300,000 a year. And the contract term is 5 years, but the maximum amount payable is $900,000. So everyone was trying to make sense of that. Is this supposed to be a 3-year contract or should we raise the limit of how much, you know, we can pay off this contract, things like that. The other issue is that there's no finalized version of a policy and procedures list. And I think this was kind of the main concern because like we talked about before, especially when it comes to juvenile justice, basically how you implement certain ideas are super important and the impact that, you know, small changes in a program can have on a child are pretty dramatic. So I think the council is rightfully pretty nitpicky here in terms of seeing a finalized version. So there was a draft version of the policy and procedure list that made it to the council. But first of all, it wasn't attached to the contract. Like legally, it was not attached to the contract. And, you know, the administration, you know, said that it wasn't a finalized version. So basically they were saying, you know, before we're going to move ahead with this, we want to see a finalized version of procedures. And then, you know, we'll consider it again. So at the end of the day, the council asked the administration to withdraw the contract request and come back when they had fixed some of those typos and had finalized those policies and procedures.
But in regards to that, some other information came to light regarding a short-term cooperative endeavor agreement and work that is already moving forward on this program. Explain what's going on there.
So the council did not approve the contract. So some of them were pretty surprised when it came out that actually the program had started as of this week, was accepting referrals from the court, and the Family Center of Hope was running the program. So basically what happened here is that this is a multi-year CEA, the one that the city council is considering now. And so for multi-year contracts, the city council has to approve them. However, if it's less than a year, the mayor can do that on her own. So what happened was the administration signed a 5-month contract with the Family Center to run this Evening Reporting Center. And basically it was an interim measure until the council approved this multi-year contract. But yeah, I mean, some of the council members seemed a little uncomfortable with the fact that they still didn't know what the policies and procedures were. They haven't seen this 5-month, you know, short-term contract. And yet this program has started. Kids are already being referred.
I mean, ultimately, if the council has no oversight of that, it's not on them to be responsible for it. I guess this falls entirely on the mayor. So what have you found regarding the mayor's selection of the Family Center of Hope to run this Evening Reporting Center?
Yeah, we don't know much. The administration did not respond to multiple requests for comment on the story. You know, like I mentioned earlier, one of the few things that we know is that it wasn't their first choice. So they had originally chosen the Youth Empowerment Project to run it before that organization backed out. But, Yeah, we really don't know why. I got a statement actually from the administration after the story was already published. Their explanation was pretty much that here they were not investing in the construction of a new building. They were investing in services that the family center could provide. So they were basically saying, regardless of their track record with building a community center, there's a separate track record that they have with programming and serving the children of New Orleans. So that was the most information that we got about how they came to choose this nonprofit.
And any details from the Youth Empowerment Program about why they pulled out of the contention?
Yeah, it was interesting. So they sent a letter to the administration that kind of laid out some of the reasons why, and it was a little vague, a little opaque, but looking at the timing can give you an idea. So the CEA between YEP and the city was approved by the city council on May 9th. YEP ended up sending this letter, dropping out of the project, on May 20th. Now, what happened between May 9th and May 20th was actually highly written about at the time. It was right about the time that there was this very high-profile attempted car burglary that resulted in a shootout that left the owner of the car dead. That happened on May 9th. And Cantrell went to a press conference about it, and the press conference was kind of a turning point in a lot of people's eyes in terms of how the administration talked about and approached juvenile justice. So up to that point, the rhetoric had been really centered on rehabilitation, on education over incarceration. But after this carjacking and shooting, there seemed to be a little bit more emphasis put on the fact that there are dangerous juveniles out there that need to be kept off the streets, supposedly. So that rhetoric kind of escalated over the next couple weeks, and it was soon after that the administration announced that they would be enforcing the curfew for kids under the age of 17 once again. So YEP acknowledged in their letter that, you know, the environment around this project had changed significantly since they started working on it. So that kind of gives a clue into what they were thinking at the time.
Michael, this is a really layered and very interesting story. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
NOLA Public Schools is touting its graduation rate index. The number is part of state school ratings, which came out last month, and that number for the district increased by 20 points. But the graduation rate index isn't the same as the graduation rate. Here to explain the difference between the two statistics is Lens Education reporter Marta Jusen. Hi, Marta.
Hey, Jess.
So what is the graduation rate index?
So the index is a separate measure, and although it is based off of the actual graduation rate, what the state is doing is they are translating that graduation rate, which, you know, we normally think of as being on a 100-point scale, like our graduation rate is 77%, for example. But the index, which the state uses for its overall scores for schools, is based on a 150-point scale. So they're kind of multiplying that number up by a little bit to translate it to that 150-point scale.
And why do they have a 150-point scale rather than a 100-point scale?
That's just a scale that the state uses for the school performance scores that they issue every year. I do think it is rather confusing for the district to be talking about their graduation rate index, because when they come out and say, hey, our grad rate index is 86.4, probably a lot of people are thinking that that's the actual graduation rate, when in fact it's not.
Yeah, it seems that they could perhaps call it just the graduation index instead of the graduation rate index to kind of separate that in people's minds, because it does make it sound, for people who don't know, which is probably most people, it makes it sound like we have an over 80% graduation rate when you actually said it's in the high 70s.
Right, it's about 77%. I actually think that there's no reason for anyone to be talking about the graduation rate index at all, because it is just, you know, a tool that the state is using, not, you know, something that's going to make sense, like you said, for a lot of people, just on face value.
And you said in your story that the reason for the sort of weighted index number, it has something to do with a school getting a failure or not on its graduation rate.
Right. So the state has, on that 150-point scale, they have separated into buckets what they want that A, B, C, D, or F to look like. And kind of that pivotal number is 76%. So because the district had a 72% graduation rate last year, now they've moved up to 77. They crossed that threshold. And when you cross that threshold, suddenly every point of your graduation rate becomes worth more than 1 point in the index. It's a very, like, confusing, jargony calculation that really is not needed for anything but behind-the-scenes work, which is why I think it's strange to be bringing it out in the first place. You know, in recent meetings, that has kind of been the number that people have been focusing on. They've been flashing that up higher and bigger font, and other education agencies and organizations, nonprofits in the city have been talking about that number too. So when we took a look at it and we said, hey, a 20-point jump, you know, wow, what's going on? And I just wanted to learn how it was done. And when I started looking into it, I said, oh, you know, this is not something anyone's going to know on face value. I certainly didn't. So that's why we wanted to write this fun little story.
Yeah, because there's some processing of numbers to represent something different that most people aren't considering. So the message here is not to take the graduation rate index out of context.
Exactly. And so, and we didn't. Increased by 5 percentage points in the graduation rate. And that's fantastic. And I think that's what we should be talking about, not this 20-point increase that, you know, really doesn't make sense for a lot of people, especially when you see it and you might assume that it's going to be on that 100-point scale, but it's not.
And so how is this number, this indexed number, used in school, in state school ratings?
So what goes into high school scores is that an ACT score, they're just straight assessments. The strength of their diplomas, and then they do count the graduation rate, but it's calculated on that grad rate index scale. So it's on that 150-point scale.
So we should be happy for NOLA Public Schools that the graduation rate increased, because it's always good for students to see that happen. But let's remember that it was a 5% graduation rate increase, and, you know, hopefully we'll continue that positive upward trend next year. Marta Jusen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week, we ran a 3-part series on the arrest, trial, and imprisonment of Aaron Hunter. A lawyer with the Innocence Project of New Orleans says Hunter is someone who became, quote, caught up in a perfect storm of New Orleans bullshit. Reporter Nick Krastel spent months working on the story as part of a partnership between The Lens and The Atavist. Nick Krastel joins me now. So, Nick, let's start with the very basics, because this is a complicated story. Who is Aaron Hunter?
Aaron Hunter grew up in New Orleans in the Ninth Ward, and, you know, as a young man, he got into some trouble with the law, and he went to a juvenile correctional center for a period of his youth. And then when he got out, he had a few jobs here and there, but ended up becoming sort of a small-time drug dealer and what's known as a fence. He was moving stolen goods. Some electronics and weapons as well.
So the reason we're talking about Aaron Hunter is because of a murder in 1987. Tell me what happened with that murder. What was the story there?
Sure. So a man named Gregory Jones was killed in New Orleans East in 1987. And it's unclear what exactly happened. He was shot 2 times in front of his house. At the scene, there were just a handful of witnesses, the most important of whom would come to be his girlfriend at the time, a woman named Vanessa Causey, who told police that she saw a man named Willie leaving the scene of the crime and that Willie and Gregory had a fight earlier in the day. So that was, you know, at the time of the murder, sort of all that the police gathered. They also found some drugs on the scene and some suggestion that Gregory may have been dealing drugs.
So someone named Willie was identified as the key suspect, but Aaron Hunter wound up being charged and convicted. So how did we get from Willie to Aaron Hunter?
That's a good question, and kind of one of the cruxes of the story. So what ended up happening is the case was passed over to a detective named Jacqueline Davis, who was the first black female homicide detective in New Orleans history. She had encountered all sorts of hardship in her life and also a tremendous amount of racism and antagonism when she joined the police force. She ended up being assigned the case about a month after the murder. and had actually worked with Vanessa Causey. Previously, Vanessa Causey had claimed to be the victim of a rape, and Detective Davis had put a man away for I believe, 50 years for raping her. So she had known the witness prior to the murder. So about 2 months after the murder, Detective Davis claims that she finally was able to get in touch with Vanessa Causey. The previous detective wasn't able to. And when she did, Vanessa Causey said that Willie was, in fact, Aaron Hunter, and that at the time of the murder, she had been too afraid to remember his name. On the exact same day, seemingly coincidentally, police found the gun that was used to murder Gregory in Aaron Hunter's house. Between those two facts, Hunter was arrested and charged with the murder.
So Aaron Hunter is charged with the murder and goes to trial. What was Aaron Hunter's trial like?
Well, I asked him about that, and he said, well, what little there was. His trial took place in a single morning. His testimony on his own behalf lasted about 10 minutes. His attorney couldn't remember the name of the street that the murder took place on, and which was confusing to Hunter on the stand, somewhat understandably. So it's a somewhat shocking trial transcript to read. You know, this at the time was not particularly unique. The judge in Aaron's trial was known for doing these incredibly quick trials. He once did 6 felony trials in a single day, and he took great pride in that. He saw it as a sign of efficiency in the criminal justice system. So Aaron's trial really lacked any sort of depth or interrogation into whether or not he was in fact guilty of the crime. It was more or less perfunctory.
So, yeah, you know, and this trial was in 1988, which wasn't terribly long ago, but certainly, you know, under different circumstances in New Orleans and in New Orleans' criminal justice system.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at the time, you know, there was a overwhelming sort of fear of crime in the city. Racism and racial tension was in many ways more pronounced. I believe at the time there was only a single black judge, and that judge hadn't even been elected. He had been appointed. So there are lots of elements to the criminal justice system that, I mean, and, you know, the Office of the Indigent Defender Program we still have a vastly underfunded public defender's system, but at the time it was even sort of more sparse. And so there were all these different factors that sort of contributed to the way that Aaron's case was handled, investigated, and, you know, ultimately tried.
So this was a jury trial, and what was Aaron Hunter's sentence?
Aaron was given life in prison without parole, without the possibility of parole.
Where was Aaron Hunter sentenced to serve his time in prison, and what was his life like?
So Aaron was sent to Louisiana State Penitentiary, or Angola, and pretty soon after he got there, he became pretty involved in what's known as being an inmate counsel. So he started to work on other people's cases. He had learned a lot about the law during his appeals process, and he filed many of his own appeals. And so he became involved in helping other inmates at Angola, trying to prove their innocence, trying to litigate their cases from behind bars. And also he would work on disciplinary proceedings within the prison. So he really rose to sort of prominence in that position. I talked to the former prison librarian, a man named Norris Henderson, who said that other inmates would seek out Aaron Hunter to work on their cases. And in addition to that, he gained this reputation of having an incredible amount of integrity and character in the place. He gathered these, like, you know, dozens of testimonials from both prison guards and fellow prisoners testifying to kind of their respect for him and the fact that he was willing to help people and take seriously their situations and often willing to put their lives in front of his own.
Aaron Hunter's case then had a second set of eyes, another look was given to his case due to the involvement by the Innocence Project of New Orleans, which works with a lot of convicted persons on kind of trying to dig through and say maybe they were wrongfully convicted. What was the process and what was the outcome with the Innocence Project's investigation into Mr. Hunter's case?
One of the ways that the Innocence Project became aware of Aaron Hunter's case was because a woman named Lori White, who is now a sitting judge, was the prosecutor on his case. And she wrote a letter to the Innocence Project saying that while she didn't have any evidence that Aaron was innocent, she did remember that the single eyewitness in the case, I think she used the term, was of dubious character, and that his attorney was a walkover, to say the least. So with sort of that recommendation, the Innocence Project did a significant amount of investigating and looked back at Aaron's case and re-interviewed many people. The single eyewitness at that point had died already. But what they did find was what they considered evidence that perhaps the detective in the case, this woman, Jacqueline Davis, had found out that Aaron Hunter had the murder weapon and then used that information to pressure the single eyewitness into naming him and to changing her story. The evidence that they found, though, was somewhat limited, and when they took it to other attorneys and kind of sat with it, I think they determined that it wasn't enough to officially represent Hunter in court. Another factor was that they took the evidence back to Lori White, who at that point had become a judge, and asked for her take on it in hopes that she would maybe either sign an affidavit or in some way sign on to help Aaron Hunter. And she said that she was not interested because partially I think she was not compelled by the evidence. But this comes from one of the Innocence Project lawyers who worked on the case. Lori White herself has said that she does not remember this particular conversation, so it's hard to know exactly what went on.
It's interesting to me that he was in possession of the gun months after the murder. He was named months after the murder and found on the same day to be in possession of the gun. But we're talking about someone who is also dealing in drugs and stolen objects, pawning stolen objects. So did that ever come up as a possibility for how he came in possession of the weapon?
Yes, it did. The gun was stolen on the morning of the murder. The gun was stolen from a woman named Susan Wolf's house in Lakeview and used that very night. The gun was then found in Aaron Hunter's house, as you said, 2 months later. And it was found not when they came to arrest him for murder, but when they came to arrest him on a stolen goods charge. So they found that gun and I believe 4 other guns. Aaron was arrested on the stolen goods charge. He bailed himself out and went back to his house where he had been arrested. And then about 4 days later was arrested on the murder charge. So, I mean, what he told me was that if he had known that any one of the guns that he had been trafficking were used in a murder, he would have left town because he knew that the cops were now in possession of those. That did come up at the trial. It was his first time seeing the gun at the trial, and his lawyer asked him where he got it, and he said, "I got it from a man named Willie," which of course was the name of the initial suspect that Vanessa Causey, the eyewitness, named. He said, "I got it from a man named Willie Harris." Willie Harris was in fact a real person and had been killed a number of weeks earlier. Whether or not Hunter was aware of that fact is unclear.
So Aaron Hunter really made something of his life in prison, which I feel like, and maybe it's because we're journalists, but I feel like we hear a lot of these stories coming out of Angola. You know, you mentioned Norris Henderson. Chico Yancey is someone that I've spoken to who knew Norris at Angola, and they worked together in prison. They worked together out of prison to help inmates. So what became of Aaron Hunter?
So as I was writing this story, Aaron Hunter died in prison, and he was 56 years old. But, you know, Aaron Hunter, he really consciously was modeling himself after some of these guys who would go on to, you know, serve their community following their incarceration. And I think more than anything wanted to be able to get out and to do the same kind of similar work that they were doing. But of course, he wasn't able to.
And when you talked to Hunter, he maintained his innocence and at the time of his death had no prospect of getting out of prison.
Yes, he always maintained his innocence, and there was no real good legal recourse for him to, you know, file a post-conviction relief petition or something. He had already done that. But he always held out hope that he could maybe strike a deal with the district attorney's office. You know, for a really brief period, the district attorney's office and the Innocence Project had what they called a conviction, I believe it was called a conviction integrity unit, where they were trying to go back and look at some of these cases where maybe the conviction was a little bit weak and with people with particularly good disciplinary records in prison and maybe work out some sort of a deal. And Aaron's case was actually one that they were looking at. But unfortunately for Aaron, that project fell apart after about a year. So there were some, you know, if he found people who were friendly to his case and could convince them that, you know, the society would be better served with him out of prison, then he was going to try and do that.
Nick Krastel, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, please consider supporting independent journalism in New Orleans. The Lens is participating in NewsMatch, a national matching gift campaign that drives donations to nonprofit newsrooms like us around the country. And readers like you can play a key role in keeping our newsroom strong. From now through December 31st, NewsMatch will match every new monthly donation 12 times and double any one-time donation up to $1,000. For a nonprofit like us, this is a big deal and will help us deliver the kind of innovative journalism you've come to expect every day. This news can't wait, so why would you? Donate today at thelensnola.org/donate. And thank you.